Good morning, Council.
Morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
Counsel for Lamphey, last name. Please state the name for me so I can pronounce it. Fedprachnon?
I think it's Pepperjohn.
I believe.
What is it?
Pepperjohn, I think, is what is in the district court record, but I realize that's not your client, right, Counsel?
You are correct. I knew it was easier once I heard it than saying it.
I'm going, my clerk pointed out to me, thankfully, that was in the district court's transcript.
Excellent. All right, I'm going to call the case. A24-0933, Realty Pros LLC Respondent versus Lamphey Pepperjohn Defendant, American Investments LLC Counsel, welcome. You have each 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. We are live streaming this argument. We'll maintain an audio version only for our public website. When you start your arguments, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. The podium toggles up and down by a switch sort of waist high. And counsel for appellant, when you're ready, we are ready for you.
Well, good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jared Gorlitz, and I represent the appellant and intervening party, American Investments, LLC. I'm just trying to give a brief background to this case before I get into the legal arguments, and please ask me if there's any clarification on that. Mr. Pearson, I've lived this case, so some of the details, finer details, we may no longer appreciate as this panel may. But this is essentially a mortgage redemption case where American Investments had two mortgages, a first mortgage and a second mortgage. There was a HOA foreclosure due to the failure to pay past due assessments, and that then foreclosure would be subject to the first mortgage, but the second mortgage would be a junior creditor with the right to redeem. The purchaser of the sheriff's certificate of sale, Realty Pros, reduced the redemption period following the statutory process to do so from 6 months to 5 weeks. After that order was entered essentially by default and without appearance by anyone, American Investments learned that the redemption period had been reduced to 5 weeks and the redemption period expired and sought to intervene in the lawsuit. We came up before this court, who then reversed the district court's decision, stating American Investments didn't have an interest in the property, allowing it to intervene. So it got then remanded back to the district court. A motion to vacate was heard by the district court while there were some other motions pending, but they're not before the court today. And the court denied our motion to vacate. And now we're here before this court seeking to overturn the district court's denial of the motion to vacate. I'm going to start with standard review. I generally don't focus on that much, but here I would acknowledge that the standard review is abuse of discretion. But as we've argued, and I think is accurate, the district court misapplied the law. So I think it's important that even though it's abuse of discretion, we are looking at a legal issue, and we're looking at the legal issue of what interest, if any, did American Investments have in this property in order to bring this motion to vacate. In essence, you know, the district court, from our vantage point.
So do you think the issue is, did the district court abuse its discretion in denying Americans' motion to vacate the order reducing the redemption period? Is that what you think the issue is? I'm trying to understand what you think the issue is.
The issue is that the district court misapplied the law and then used the misapplied law to the Findon factors to deny our motion to vacate the reduced redemption order. And I've argued in my brief how I believe the district court misapplied the law, but I think it comes down to this simple concept. There is some case law that's been in the briefs, and the citations aren't important, but in essence, because Foreclosure and redemption are a statutory process. The idea is the statutes control, and we need to strictly comply with those statutes. So there's this idea that the court doesn't have the discretion to extend or expand somebody's rights when they're limited by a statute. And I agree with that case law. But that specific law does not apply here. And the reason it doesn't apply here is we're not dealing with expanding somebody's right to redeem. We're dealing with the validity of a district court order. And that sole issue comes down to Rule 60.02 and what discretion the court has under Rule 60.02 to determine whether it's going to vacate that order or not. Just so happens
so
that
I counsel, in the briefing by your opponent, they point out that that is your position, that under Rule 60, the district court is able to vacate its prior order that reducing the redemption period. But they also point out that you don't cite any case law that recognizes a district court's authority to do so.
Fair. There isn't any. I can't argue anything.
Look for it and you can't find it.
Correct.
Okay.
And the reason for that, Your Honor, is I think it's a rule interpretation issue with respect to Rule 60.02. And there aren't really many cases that talk about what authority the district court has to vacate its own orders. And I think the reason for that is we just assume we go to the rule. And what does the rule say, right? And the rule pretty clearly states that the district court has the authority to vacate an order based on essentially what's just, is the language in Rule 60.02.
So one of the cases that the district court talked about was the Palladium Holdings case, SUNY Mortgage, which is a precedential opinion of this court. It is one in which this court affirmed a district court's decision to vacate a reduction in the redemption period. Our court doesn't specifically discuss the authority of the district court under Rule 60, but it does affirm the decision. So is that case law helpful to your position? Does it cut against your position? I'm trying to understand.
Sure. I think that case is the most similar to our circumstances. But to your point, Your Honor, it doesn't really talk about what authority that the district court has to essentially vacate that order. But it is presidential authority. It is the only case that is somewhat similar to the issue we have here, and that is whether you can vacate an order reducing the redemption period. I think it's also important to note that under the reduced redemption statute, it states that you can bring a motion to vacate a reduced redemption order. It refers to Rule 60.02. So clearly the statutory construct of the reduced redemption statute is, hey, you have these rights to come in and vacate this decision. The problem, I don't want to rely too much on that case because my understanding of Palladium Holdings is that the redemption period, you know, I should back up. I actually agree with that case. I think it does apply here. It supports the fact that you can vacate the order and you can follow the process that we followed. So I think we followed the process as indicated in that case. The distinguishing issue is that case was likely decided before the six-month redemption period happened. Here, this case was decided much after the six-month redemption period would apply,
right,
because of the procedural
I think
nature.
The issue that the district court had with
Correct.
Palladium Holdings and is articulated in the district court's order.
Correct.
So, as I understand your position, you're claiming that the order reducing the redemption period should be vacated, right? Based on the Findon analysis, and that if it were vacated, that somehow the redemption period would be reinstated for your client. Is
Correct.
That right? Okay. So the second half of your argument is that the real issue under the Findon factors, the whether you have a reasonable defense on the merits, is abandonment, right? Because that's fundamental to a district court's decision to reduce the redemption period, right?
Absolutely, yep.
So as I read your brief, you have one piece of evidence in support of your position that this property was not abandoned, and it's the affidavit of Ms. Pepperjohn, the owner of the property. Am I right that that's the full extent of the record that
Correct.
You offer?
Okay. Yes.
And the district court rejected that.
I would say that it performed a misapprehension of the law and ignored that.
Help me understand that. Yeah.
Well, the district court looked at reasonable defense on the merits, and they basically said, hey, you didn't file this motion within the six-month redemption period, so you don't have any rights in this property anymore, so you don't have any reasonable claim, even though it's reasonable defense on the merits. So the court never actually applied that Findon factor appropriately to the arguments before it, which was whether the reduced redemption order should be vacated because there was a reasonable defense that Ms. Pepperjohn did not abandon the property. She never addressed that issue in her decision.
Right, but I think our case law says that because it was presented by the respondent below to the district court, the abandonment issue, they defended the abandonment determination, that this court could review that and affirm on that basis. Affirm this Findon analysis is what I'm saying. Yeah. So
I agree that this court has the authority to do that. I disagree that it should, and I can tell you why.
So tell me why. Yeah.
It's really simple. I file these motions to reduce the redemption period. Mm-hmm. And when I go to the hearing, which in Ramsey County are before the examiner of titles, in Hennepin County they're before the examiner of titles. And if the property owner simply appears at that hearing and says, I do not intend to abandon the property. I did not intend to abandon the property. The entire process stops. The court, and there's no authority for this, I'm just telling you how it happens in practice, the court basically says, well, they haven't abandoned the property, Mr. Gorlitz, your motion is denied. You could, I would say, in that instance, you could have a trial, and that's what I'm asking for here. In lieu of the competing affidavits of I didn't intend to abandon the property, and yet here are all these factors that we think indicate that you did intend to abandon the property, that to me is a factual determination made by a judge or a jury. That is not something that should be decided by the court on motion. And I think when somebody says, I didn't intend to abandon the property, that's enough
to overcome. I don't see that in Ms. Pepperjohn's affidavit, so help me out. She says she disagrees that she abandoned the property. She doesn't say she didn't intend to abandon it.
I think we're talking about two different affidavits.
Okay, help me out.
It's important to understand that when we filed the original motion to intervene, there was an affidavit from her, and it states a number of these facts, that she's an immigrant, she runs this business, she lives in
St. Do you have the date of that affidavit, counsel? I just want to make sure I follow the record correctly, and you can maybe give that to me in your rebuttal.
I can. I know it's cited to significantly in our facts because that is the affidavit we're relying upon for all the facts, so it must be document 27 in the record. Okay. And I'm looking at paragraph 2, paragraph 4, and some other paragraphs, and that's an affidavit where, to me, she says clearly she did not intend to abandon the property. Now, after that, through a settlement, Ms. Pepperjohn settled with, Ms. Pepperjohn also intervened and then through mediation settled with Realty Pros, and as part of that settlement issued a second affidavit. And as part of that second affidavit, that's the language Your Honor is referring to where she's,
no, I was not referring to that language, counsel. I was referring to the affidavits that were submitted earlier.
Okay.
All right.
And to me, if you take the earlier affidavit, I think it's clear, but I certainly would say it's reasonable that she didn't intend to abandon the property. And I met with her, and I she's the one that told me those things, and you know, you don't leave personal property that's significant somewhere. You don't leave your car in the garage. You don't you don't think I have $500,000 of equity in a property and just abandon it. To me, there are facts that she puts forward that support that she didn't intend to abandon the property.
Do those facts line up with the statutory criteria for abandonment, counsel?
I don't think they have to.
For this particular statute, right? This statute has abandonment criteria, right?
I would say that this statute has criteria that give you a prima facie standard to establish that the property has been vacant and abandoned. And that is, the property hasn't been taken care of and all these other things, which on their face, I think, provide you prima facie evidence. That's not conclusive evidence. That's simply prima facie evidence that when somebody doesn't appear at the reduced redemption hearing, the court can accept that prima facie evidence as sufficient enough to reduce the redemption period down to 5 weeks. And I don't think anybody questions the intent of the statute, right? If this property is truly vacant and abandoned, we should be able to reduce the redemption period, get it back, get it secured, get it winterized, and all those things make sense. The part that I'm trying to get this court to appreciate is it's a very low bar to show an intent not to that you don't intend to relinquish rights without ever getting them back. And the simplest thing is somebody listing that property for sale. If a property is listed for sale, it's generally considered not abandoned. Why? They're trying to sell it. And you could have, again, you could take a crazy scenario. All the things that the respondent talk about, you didn't do all these things. But if I list it for sale, I think you've satisfied that I've not abandoned this property because I didn't intend to relinquish.
We don't have that back here, do we,
counsel? We do not. I'm just using that as a fact that generally happens. Okay. Here,
we
I think...
talked about abandonment and vacant.
Yes.
All of the correction and abatement orders that the city put out, sounds like it was vacant.
There's no question it was vacant, I think.
Okay.
But the statute says it has to be vacant and abandoned. So you can, I'm just not taking care of the property, I'm not doing anything, so clearly it's vacant. But to meet the statutory requirements, I have to show abandonment, which under Black's Law Dictionary, you know, is defined as an intentional relinquishment of a right without the intent to recapture it. So to me, that comes down to what's in somebody's head, because it's what their intent is, and that would be something that the district court would have to decide at a trial with Mrs. Pepperjohn on the stand, cross-examination by Mr. Pierce, and all of the, I would call them more vacation of the property type issues because you're not taking care of the property and the like. My time's up, and so I will continue with my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. And counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jack Pierce, and I represent the respondent, Realty Pros. The standard is not only an abuse of discretion on the first Findon factor, is that this court has to find that the district court abused its discretion on all of the Findon factors. The district court determined that three of the four Findon factors that the appellant failed to meet its burden. And I understand and acknowledge that the appellant has spent a number of time on the reasonable case on the merits. What appellant did not address, and really has not addressed throughout this litigation, is its excuse for its failure to act. And the appellant says that its failure to act was because it was not a named party to the original complaint. It didn't have to be. It wasn't entitled to be a party. All the appellant had to do was place of record a single document seeking request of a notice to reduce the redemption period. It did not do so. But that's not all. If we are to believe the appellant says that it went out to view the property in October and November of 2021, which this property has been in this litigation for over 3.5 years. It went out to view the property in October and November of 2021. The summons seeking to reduce the redemption period was posted on the property in October 4 of 2021. The order by the district court saying that there was abandonment, not that there was a prima facie case. You know, counsel makes mention that there may be a prima facie case. That is not the issue because the district court ruled that there was abandonment, not prima facie, there was abandonment. That order was also posted. What is missing from the record is any evidence from the appellant demonstrating what was its reasonable excuse for its failure to act.
So, counsel, I don't see that last part of your analysis, the posting of the summons and the posting of the order along with American's investigation of the property. I don't see that in the district court's analysis for American's failure.
It's not in that part is not in the district court's analysis. Okay, the district court focused on the failure to file a document.
Right, and that, you know, there's that statutory entitlement to request notice, right?
Which was not exercised by the appellant.
They didn't exercise it. The argument that they make is that there are more than one, several cases, opinions in which the district courts have found, granted a motion to vacate under Rule 6002, finding a reasonable excuse on the merits where a party was present and had notice, at least, of proceedings, but failed to act. Usually they weren't present at the court, in the courts, often a default judgment, but they had notice. And the court nonetheless finds a reasonable excuse on the merits for other reasons.
And I agree that there are that case law. I'm just unclear as to what that is here.
What the other reasons were.
Mm-hmm. And for example, the order reducing the redemption period was placed of record. So the world has notice of it. There's no obligation for the respondent to reach out to someone who hasn't requested notice to say, oh, by the way, we've reduced the redemption period. That is an obligation the appellant has. On the reasonable case on the merits, and Mr. Gerlitz and I have discussed this frequently and have disagreed frequently. And I think it was brought up by Your Honor that there is no authority that has been pointed out to the district court or has been pointed out to this court that would allow a district court to, I call it extend the redemption period, appellant calls it restore the redemption period. It's a distinction without a difference.
Well, I guess I want to start with first things first. Rule 60 says that a district court has authority to vacate its own orders under certain conditions, obviously. Isn't the relief that an American is asking for is simply that, a vacature of the court's order reducing the redemption period?
Two answers to that. Yeah. The first is, how did it abuse its discretion? If the district court has the opportunity, and I don't think it does, and I'll get to that second, but if the district court does have the discretion to vacate and reinstate the redemption period, how did the district court abuse that discretion? Assuming that the district court could.
Well, I guess I wanted to start with, did the district court have authority to vacate
no.
the redemption order?
I'm just going to read
Not
a quote.
On the merits. I'm asking you under the rules.
No. This is an old case. It's 1892.
I know. I've read the Carr case. The problem with the Carr case, and it was pointed out by opposing counsel, is Carr was not looking at a district court's order reducing a redemption period, which is authorized by statute. It is authorized for a district court to reduce a redemption period, right?
The district court can reduce
it. Yeah,
it can reduce it.
Carr didn't involve that. Carr involved a district court order actually extending the statutory redemption period, which is, it's a difference, right?
It's the same relief. The same relief being sought is to...
It's not exactly the same relief. Counsel.
Well, it sort of begs the question then, redemption period starts when? Whose redemption period? Is it just American Investments?
That would be the next question.
Yeah.
The first question is whether the court can vacate.
I am unaware of any authority in which a court can vacate an order extending a statutorily prescribed time. I have seen no case that says it can.
That wasn't my question, counsel, but go ahead and go with your argument.
What I'm getting to is, no, I don't think the district court has that authority because it's by vacating an order, it's reinstating a right that doesn't otherwise exist.
But how could that be? If the order deserves to be vacated under Rule 60 for whatever reason, there was fraud, let's pick a different reason under there. How can there be no authority to vacate that order?
Well, Kerr speaks and says, if there's fraud, you can. But there is no fraud in this case.
Okay, so let's say there's reasonable neglect under Findon. Let's say all four factors are met. You're saying the court can't reverse or vacate its own order even though all the Findon factors are met?
No, I'm saying it can in the event the motion was brought timely before the end of the redemption period. We are now speaking about a redemption period that expired in either January or March of 2022.
Right, and then we get into whether, as a non-party, they could have done it.
And they could.
Even though they should have been able to intervene, it turns out, on appeal, that was wrongly decided at the start, right? So they waited, they pursued their rights through appeal, and then when it came back, they acted. So what's the authority? I mean, you have it cited in there, but it doesn't seem unreasonable to me, just thinking about it, that when they were not permitted to intervene as a party, that they really didn't have a ground to pursue relief under Rule 60.
They should have brought a motion under Rule 60 Even as a non-party, there's authority to do that, and with the understanding, because it's clear when the redemption period expires, with that understanding, a motion to vacate should have been brought at that time. And that's the case Palladium. In Palladium, the motion to vacate was brought prior to the expiration of the redemption period. That's the distinction between Palladium in this case.
Was there a party making that motion in Palladium?
Yes.
Okay, not a non-party.
Not a non-party, but okay. A non-party has the authority to do so.
It just seems a little, here you have a non-party who has been, you know, like battled that they can't intervene, and you're saying, well, they should have nevertheless filed a substantive motion to vacate. Even though it was plain as day, was it not that they were seeking to intervene in order to file a motion to vacate?
Whether it's plain as day as whether or not they actually did it are two different things. And that's the obligation on the appellant. And to speak to the issue of abandonment, Ms. Pepperjohn in an affidavit states that she hasn't been to the property since 2000 or 18 or 19 and didn't have any reason to go to the property. Intent is not a factor under the statute. There's a number of different, I think there's seven subparagraphs under subdivision seven. There's numerous facts in the record that indicate this property was abandoned. There's the abatement orders. There's the affidavits of the neighbors. And the only evidence that the appellant points to say, no, there wasn't, is intent. It's not a factor.
Can those other things that were characterized as going to intent not be considered? That the person has equity in the house, that the person is storing their own personal items in the house. You're saying those things can't be considered.
No, those are not in the statute. Because if you have equity in the...
That's an exhaustive list in the statute?
I believe it is exhaustive for this reason. If you can't have abandonment because there's equity in the house, if that equates to intent somehow...
I'm taking intent out. Let's just say intent isn't there. Okay. I'm just looking at the universe of facts that might suggest someone hasn't abandoned.
The universe of facts would be this. In every case in which there is an investor seeking to redeem a piece of property and reduce the redemption period, there is equity in the property. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. If the factor for abandonment is whether or not there is equity, determined by whom? What is equity? It's not in the statute. The statute speaks to whether or not the property is abandoned. Is it subject to waste? The city said it was. The neighbors have. And the fact that so much stuff was left, if you look at any of the pictures in the record of what the interior of the house looked like, that's abandonment. That's leaving the property. There isn't the subjective factors that the appellant wishes this court to read into the statute that doesn't exist. The factors are objective. And there's sufficient under 4, subdivision 7-4 and 7-6, both in Ms. Pepperjohn's statement, the statement of the neighbors, and the statement of the city. And more importantly, if the standard is abuse of discretion, how did the original judge who granted the redemption order abuse his discretion in that instance in finding abandonment? Nothing has been presented other than this nebulous concept of intent. That's it. And so if the appellant's burden is to show an abuse of discretion that there is a reasonable case on the merits, the appellant hasn't met that burden. The same thing on the due diligence factor. Now, we've already sort of spoke to this, but the law indicates, and the district court indicated in a footnote in its opinion, that the procedural moves or procedural steps, I guess is a better way of putting it, procedural steps that the appellant took were those made by the appellant. It should have and could have brought a motion to vacate within the six-month period.
Let me ask you this. So this court only needs to find that one of the Findon factors has been met. Which one do you think is your strongest?
Well, if I have to parse them out between the two, I would say reasonable case on the merits is number one, followed by excuse for failure to act is number two. I think they're close because, especially on the reasonable excuse for the failure to act, other than the argument that I should have been a party, even though the law says you should not, I don't know what the appellant's argument is on that point. I don't know how the appellant, based on the record, can show that there was a reasonable excuse for its failure to act. It wasn't entitled to be a party. That's sort of what I think is kind of the elephant in the room here. Appellant's failure to appear at the redemption at the original hearing is based on the lack of conduct of the appellant. It's seeking to excuse that. And there's nothing in the law, and I believe this is one of the questions that was asked of counsel. There's no authority to say that your failure to do something that would have entitled you to notice is reasonable. That's what this court would have to find, is that it's reasonable for a party not to exercise its rights and then be afforded those rights as if it had. That's essentially the argument that appellant is making without saying it, that I'm entitled to have notice of this hearing, even though I didn't request to have notice of it. And I think that the district court, on the three factors that it did find with respect to the Findon analysis that were adverse to the appellant, that it did not abuse its discretion. And the relief sought by the appellant is not one that is recognized by law. I think the district court properly so concluded, and I respectfully request that this court do as well. And if the court has nothing further for me, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you. A few things to unpack here, I think. First of all, with respect to the Findon factor as to whether we have a reasonable excuse to act. A reasonable excuse to act as...
For failure to act.
Yes. As Judge Buffel said, we weren't a party. We didn't have notice of something, so we didn't appear.
But
right?
You could have requested to have notice.
Which is a voluntary right under the statute. And I say over here, I got personal service of a lawsuit and I didn't appear. We can find reasonable excuse to act or failure to act here, but we can't under a voluntary statute?
What is the reason, though? Usually when someone doesn't answer, even though they've been served, they say why they should be reasonably excused for their failure to answer. And I think the question is here, are you just saying, is the reasonable excuse just simply that they didn't have to do it?
Two separate issues.
Okay.
Why didn't they file the voluntary request for notice? They didn't have to do it. They could have done it. They didn't have to do it.
Even though they knew about proceedings happening relative to this property.
They didn't know about the proceeding to reduce the redemption period.
No.
They knew about the foreclosure, but there's no evidence they knew anything about this reduced redemption action. It was reasonable for them not to participate, respond, and oppose to the reduced redemption action because they weren't a party, which, therefore, they didn't know anything about it. If they were a party, they would have known about it. They weren't a party, so they didn't know about it. So it's reasonable for them not to participate in an action because they didn't know about it. There's no dispute that they could have followed a voluntary process. But when we have this case law where I actually have been served with a summons and I have a reasonable excuse, how can you say that I didn't follow a voluntary statutory process and that doesn't give me a reasonable excuse?
Factual determination somewhere or basis to make it that you didn't know about it? Because part of the question came up as it was posted, et cetera, but the district court didn't rely on that. How do we know that? Is there something saying we didn't know about that?
There are affidavits in the record from my client where he says, you know, the client didn't know about the proceeding. It's also stated in our complaint for intervention that we didn't know about this. We just found out about it in January of 2021, which is why we followed this process to intervene.
But there's no findings about that by the district court, because it sounds sort of perhaps arguably inconsistent with the idea that, or maybe your client hadn't been there personally. Is that what the, or did you?
I think Mr. Pierce has created some confusion. So there's an inspection report in the file where somebody went and inspected the property, not my client. When somebody goes and inspects the property, they drive by and look at it. They don't go to the front door and see what's posted on it. They simply see if somebody is there.
It seems like I'm nosy enough that if I see something posted on a house.
Would you know that from the street in the middle of the winter?
Yes.
Okay.
We have a house in foreclosure near our home.
Okay. I would say there's no evidence in the record that at the time my client had somebody inspect the property, there was something posted in the window that they could see. So to me, we're getting far afloat. Mr. Pierce from day one has said they could have filed a request for notice. And my response is we are way far from the standard on the Findon factor for reasonable excuse to fail to act. There is no evidence my client was aware of a proceeding to reduce the redemption period. Because they weren't aware, how can you say they can't have an excuse for not responding or failing to act? They didn't know about it. No, and that is much greater than somebody who's actually personally served. So I think that Findon factor has been completely satisfied. Running out of time.
On the due diligence factor, it seems to me that the district court in part relied on the Rule 60 provision that indicates that if you seek to vacate based on a reasonable excuse, which is what your client is asking, it should be done within a year. And you failed to do that. So what's your response and under the due diligence prong?
We couldn't do it. There's been this idea tossed around that we could bring a Rule 60.02 motion. The cases cited by the district court judge, number one, support our position, as we've argued in our brief. Number two, it says, well, we can expand your rights under Rule 60.2, so if you can appeal, you're also a party, or you also can bring a motion to vacate. There is nothing that says we have to make
them. So you could file a complaint in intervention, and your complaint in intervention did, in fact, say you were going to move to vacate. Why could you not, as a plaintiff intervener, purported intervener, as of right, also file a motion to vacate? Just in light of the one-year deadline and the Rule 60 rule. I'm sorry, Presiding Judge, I assume it's okay if I go a little
yes,
over.
Yes, please.
Okay.
My short answer to that is if you read 60.02, it says a party can bring essentially the motion. I go to the rule. I read the rule. And what did it say? A party had to bring the motion. So I think there's been some discretion that could be expanded. But as the letter of the law says, you have to bring a party, have to be a party to bring a motion to vacate. So we didn't bring a motion to vacate until we were made a party. And there is no precedential authority in this district that says we could bring a motion to vacate.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both. Thanks for your briefing and your oral arguments. The case is submitted, and we'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.